And it is today's topical currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman returns tomorrow. This hour, we begin with historian Eli Zaretsky. He's a professor at the New York School for Social Research, and we'll discuss his book, Why America Needs a Left, a Historical Argument. And he joins us from New York City. Welcome to you, Professor Zaretsky.
Thank you for having me.
So touch on the three movements that you highlight as the pinnacles of liberal thoughts and policies in American history.
Yes. So my argument in the book is that we've always had a left at the crucial moments that we need a left. We haven't had a continuous left as you have in France or in Germany, for example, but we have our own unique form of the left, in that there were three basic moments when a left came to the fore and played a crucial role in shaping American history, American identity. And the three lefts I have in mind are the abolitionists, the socialists, and the new left of the 1960s.
Well, if we need a left, don't we need a right as well?
Well, I don't think there's any problem having a right. We're always gonna have a right. In fact, we have several rights in this country. We have a conservative right. We have a libertarian right, and so forth. The simple answer is yes. We're gonna have we have a right, a center, and a left. That's the nature of modern politics. So yes, we need a right. But what I'm trying to argue in the book, I think many people say, "Well, we don't need it." Many people would say we don't need a left. We need a center, and so forth. Obama said that, and I'm arguing we need a left.
You say the left began in the French Revolution. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, it began in the 18th century when we created modern democratic societies. And you can see this very clearly in Europe, because in Europe you have a parliamentary system, and so everything is organized in terms of right, center, and left. You have right-wing parties, center parties, and left parties. In the United States, we have a two-party system, and originally those two parties had lefts and rights within each party. So it was not as clear in the United States, but I'm trying to show that the United States had its counterpart to the European system, and that there's always been a left in the United States also.
Tell me about radical liberalism of the 20th century, particularly in the 60s. Didn't that lay the groundwork for a lot of the conservative movements, a la Ronald Reagan, the SDS, the Weather Underground bombings, and
you mean you think of someone like Reagan as reacting against the new left?
Yes,
and that's what you're saying. Yes, well, you know that's always a danger. And in moments when you have great moments of reform and social change, you always have a counter movement against it. For example, when we had the New Deal, we really created the modern middle class in the 1930s and 40s. We had the GI Bill, we created the university system, we created the roads, we industrialized the South, and so forth. But then we had a counter-reaction against it in the form of McCarthyism. And it's also true that in the 1960s, when we also had a radical movement, for example, women's liberation and the anti-war movement, and of course the civil rights movement, you had a reaction against it in the Reagan was an example of that. He was governor of California and so forth.
So is there historically a sort of a pendulum that swings back and forth, and is that good or bad?
Well, I don't think it's a pendulum. I'm not a person who thinks we just need the left. I'm not that kind of leftist. I'm saying we need the left. But not only the left. I don't think it's a pendulum, because what we have in America, we have a center. Center is different from the left. The center is, we have a basic agreement on individual rights, on individual freedoms. We all agree about that. And what I argue in my book is that for that center to work, for our basic Jeffersonian, Madisonian, Washingtonian ideals of freedom, for them to work, we need a left to push the center, to bring up the question of equality. So it's really the relationship between the center and the left that's the dynamic relationship in American history, and not a pendulum between left and right.
Just a minute ago, you said, "I'm not that type of leftist."
Leftist.
So
yeah.
What breed are you?
Well, I believe in our tradition of individual freedom and political liberty. I do think that's the basis for anything. I see the left as something that is criticizing and improving that tradition. For example, in the case of the first left, the abolitionists, no one believed in freedom more than the slaveholders. They believed in the freedom to hold slaves. So you can't just say, I believe in freedom. I have my freedom. These are my slaves. I own these slaves. You can't do that. So a left emerged and said, we also believe in freedom, but we believe in equal freedom. So I'm a kind of leftist that bases my ideals of equality on principles of individual freedom, but it's equal freedom.
We're speaking with historian Eli Zaretsky. He's a professor at the New York School for Social Research, and we're talking about his book, Why America Needs a Left, A Historical Argument. If you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, if you'd like to chime in with a comment or a question. So tell me, Eli Zaretsky,
yes,
what criticisms do you have for today's liberal left adherents, or so-called?
Well, my argument actually comes out of the situation that we're in today. We are in a dramatic situation. In other words, the left is not something permanent in American life. It's something that comes to the fore when we have a basic problem. Our first left came to the fore when slavery became intolerable. Our second left came to the fore when capitalism had to be reformed, when we needed trade unions, we needed Social Security, we needed public health care, and so forth. And we're in a situation today of dramatically increased inequality and dramatically reduced opportunity. And so we need reforms today, but in order for those reforms to have meaning and to connect those reforms up with our American, our deeper values, we need a left that pushes those reforms in a direction of equality. These reforms might be the same sorts of reforms that people are talking about: reforming the banking system, reforming the healthcare system, providing jobs, and so forth. But I'm saying that we need people to articulate that our core principles as Americans are principles of equality, social equality. And we have a past, when every time in the past we have faced the kind of problems that we face today, we have been able to look inward and find within ourselves principles of equality that have guided us, and we can do that today.
You brought up Social Security. I was wondering, as a historian, if you could compare the disdain for Social Security in its day versus the current disdain by many for the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a critic of the Affordable Care Act from the left. We could have, and we will do much better. But they're both analogies. Social Security totally revolutionized the condition of old people in America. You're speaking from Florida. It is a beautiful thing to walk around in Florida and see how many people are walking around healthy and well in their 80s and 90s. And that is in good part because of Social Security. But when Social Security came around, people said this thing, this is communism, this is government control. We can handle ourselves. We can provide for ourselves. If you don't provide for yourself, too bad for you, you know, and so forth. And so people died in their 50s and 60s or did not have health care in their old age or were reliant on their family. And it's the same thing today. People cannot be, you know, they can. Modern health care is too expensive. It's too complicated and so forth to just let every individual out into the marketplace and fend for themselves. We need more planning, more control, and leadership and government support in order to make health care available to all. And this will be just like Social Security. It's potentially going to revolutionize our health and make us healthier.
We're speaking with historian Eli Zaretsky. We're talking about his book, Why America Needs a Left. And we're going to take a short break and be back with more. And 20 minutes past 1 o'clock, it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman will return to the program tomorrow when we'll visit with writer Carl Hiaasen. So you certainly don't want to miss that. Just by way of a little bit of news, this morning we made a shipment of books, and there's probably well over 100 of some of the books that we receive here at Topical Currents. New books, hardcover, and we gave them to Give Good Works Charity. It serves at-risk women and others, many of them in recovery. It's at 24th Street in Miami. You can say hello to Heather, the CEO of Give Good Works. And many of the books are from the authors we featured on Topical Currents. So if you've heard interviews from authors that you were interested in, you can should go up there and get them while the selection is best. That's 24th Street in Miami at Miami Avenue. 24th Street and Miami Avenue. And by the way, historian Eli Zaretsky's book, Why America Needs a Left, A Historical Argument, made its way to charity also. How do you like that, Eli?
I'm very pleased, and I support that 100%.
Okay, very good. Tell me about, I was around in the 60s. Many people really lamented, you talk about that's the third wave of American liberalism, but many people really lamented the culture of drugs, rock, sexual promiscuity, and other sorts of fun.
Right.
What is your view of people who really resent that period?
Well, I'm not so sympathetic. My daughter was born in 1970, and she writes a book about growing up in that kind of environment in San Francisco. And she has a preface, which her book is not about that, but her preface is about that. And I was very moved when she wrote it, because she talked about what a warm and supportive childhood she had and how good it was to grow up in that kind of environment. Obviously, my God, you know, the tragedy of Philip Seymour Hoffman. I mean, how can one not just be just horrified in every fiber of one's being when a great performer like that is lost, you know, to a drug? And obviously, these things harmed people and so forth. But overall, the counterculture of the 1960s and 70s was a positive development. It loosened up the society. It freed various kinds of sexuality, which we see today in the gay movement and transgender movement and so forth. I think very few people understand that Silicon Valley and the whole computer revolution all comes out of the Cultural Revolution of the 60s. These were nerd part of it, and a lot of our music, Patti Smith and Lou Reed and so forth. So, you know, I think it was more positive than negative.
How has today's Tea Party embraced some of the tactics of the left of the 60s and 70s and their demonstrations and protests.
Well, they show the power that a minority can have by sticking to its principles and insisting on principles as opposed to compromise all the time. When Obama said he was going to become a president on the basis of compromising with the other people, I thought that was a politically brilliant statement, but I never thought he would actually seriously try to put it into practice because, you know, you have to, in politics, you have to, fight for your principles. Sometimes you compromise, sometimes you have to stand firm and so forth. So I think the Tea Party has used many of the tactics that are historically have been associated with the left. The problem with the Tea Party is that it doesn't really stand for anything that is plausible. I mean, you can't run a modern society just on the basis of, as if we're all small businessmen, all we need is, we want to get the government off our backs from our little grocery stores or something like that. We're dealing with highly complex global problems. We need science. We need modern thinking, modern forms of coordination and so forth. The Tea Party doesn't understand that. It's a kind of a 19th century phenomenon.
Was Occupy Wall Street a failure?
No. I think, again, Occupy Wall Street shows why America needs a left. My argument, why America needs a left. Occupy Wall Street erupted in September of
2011.
I'm sorry, yeah, thank you. 2011. And up until then, you could not talk about class inequality in America. It was simply off the charts. If you said, look how much gap there is between rich and poor, look how the rich are monopolizing all the wealth, anything like that, and you were just accused of class struggle or being a communist or being divisive and so forth. Occupy Wall Street, using the traditional tactics of the left, the most important is agitation, they made that issue, dramatized that issue, gave it a language, created the brilliant figure of the 99% and 1%, and then that became, Obama then took that over and made that his theme when he ran in his own muted way when he ran for his second term. Now you can't pick up the newspaper without reading about inequality. So in that sense, Occupy Wall Street was a fantastic success. It was a failure, and this is exactly why I wrote the book. It was a failure because it just then disappeared. And my argument is we need a sort of permanent Occupy Wall Street. We need teach-ins about the economic crisis and how that affects literature, theater,
Boy, I haven't heard that in decades.
Exactly. Well, that was a great innovation of the left, and you could say that they had it about slavery and that they had it in the 30s, but of course the term comes from the 1960s. People took the war in Vietnam and the government said, you don't know anything about the war in Vietnam, and we have the inside information and just follow us. And instead we did. I'm a college professor. I knew what brought the war about and what a mistake it was, what a disaster it was. And in the teach-ins, we didn't just talk about Vietnam, but we talked about women's rights. We talked about how the university is organized. We talked about capitalism, about the banks. Many people spoke, and so forth. We need that kind of thing today. We need to organize inside the Democratic Party. I wanted, at the time of Occupy Wall Street, I was active in Occupy Wall Street, I wanted us to go to the Democratic Convention and demand 99 seats to represent the 99%. We need dramatic actions of that sort. We need a kind of continuing presence in American life and not just a series of demonstrations and then go home.
So how did that 99-seat business go over?
They never went. I couldn't convince people to do it. See, we did that in 1964 in the Civil Rights Movement. Black were not allowed to vote in the South. When there's party convention, there are all sorts of challenges for seats. So we sent up representatives from Mississippi, the Freedom Democratic Party, and we demanded seats and so forth. We got a lot of coverage. We publicized the issue of suppression of black voting rights in Mississippi, and I wanted us to do the same thing about Occupy Wall Street in 2012.
No matter how well-intentioned Eli Zaretsky your views are they really adaptable in 2014? I mean, you're talking back to 1964 political conventions.
Absolutely. They're totally, they could not be more adaptable. What is not adaptable, what is not really realistic, is our present system. We are creating good jobs for fewer and fewer people. If we think about it just globally, there are about 8 billion people in the world. We do not have 8 billion jobs. We are not going to. There's at least 2 or 3 billion people completely outside of the economic system. If you read the newspapers, you see how read the Financial Times every day now with the decline in emerging markets and so forth. We need greater forms of coordination, greater forms of planning, and that means a left. And I think,
well,
it's not, go on.
I certainly want to thank you. We've just about run out of time. We've been speaking with historian Eli Zaretsky, professor at the New York School for Social Research. We've been talking about his book, Why America Needs a Left. And we certainly want to thank you for your time, Professor Zaretsky.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Next, literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez and writer Sharman Alexie.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman here. In 1992, a young Native American writer named Sharman Alexie was first acclaimed. The New York Times Book Review called him one of the great lyric voices of his time. Since then, Alexie has lived up to that praise with a steady stream of poetry and fiction, which takes on an uncompromising look at modern Native American life, both on and off the reservation. His latest book is a collection of short stories called Blasphemy. Sharman Alexie recently visited with Topical Currents literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez, who wanted to know what it was like to grow up on a reservation.
Well, our reservation is very isolated. And there was no real tourism to speak. I mean, you didn't get to our reservation except on purpose. It was about 90% Indian, and about 80% of that is Spokane Indian. So I really grew up in a monoculture. That was physically beautiful. I mean, really one of the most gorgeous places in the world, with the Columbia River, the Spokane River, endless streams and creeks and lakes and deer and moose and elk and cougars wandering through town and bears falling asleep on the roof of the Catholic Church. A really gorgeous place, but very poor. Third world poverty is what I grew up in. I didn't have running water or electricity until I was 7. So it was a combination of physical beauty and abject poverty.
Many of your characters are alcoholics. How prevalent is that disease in the Indian community?
Well, it's an epidemic in the Indian world, but it's an epidemic in the whole world. The measure of the social problem of drinking is really determined by how much you're paying for your drinks. If you're an alcoholic who's paying a lot of money for your drinks, that's deemed more socially acceptable than if you're drinking cheap booze. It's more desirable to be a highly functioning alcoholic than it is to be a non-functioning alcoholic. That said, it is a serious problem among Native Americans. I've had a few dozen relatives die of alcoholism, including my father 10 years ago, who died of all sorts of kidney failure, liver failure, related to a lifetime of alcoholism. So I'm a recovering alcoholic. I've been sober for 20 years, but it's everywhere in my life.
There's a New Zealand movie from the 1990s.
Once Were Warriors.
Once Were Warriors. It's about Maoris who were once proud warriors, but now they're unemployed, alcoholics, abusive to their families. When I read your stories, that term, once were warriors, rings in my head, because your protagonist, Victor, in many of your stories, who's, I think, perhaps a autobiographical, semi-autobiographical, it keeps mentioning the warrior past of Indians. How important is that?
Well, it's a nostalgia, and it's a dangerous nostalgia. I mean, I guess you could call that worship of the warrior past. It's sort of a native version of conservatism, worshiping something that didn't exist like that, especially in my tribe. You know, I've had my other stories talk about characters making fun of the warrior idea. My tribe were fishermen. You know, plenty of tribes did not have warrior cultures.
They weren't Apache warriors.
Yeah, no, and who did not practice warfare in the way that we assign it, you know, Plains Indian warfare or Apaches. There were plenty of tribes that were pacifist, who were fishing people who were fairly non-nomadic. there were farming tribes. So this whole idea of being a warrior is destructive to us.
It holds you back, perhaps.
Yeah, it holds us back. But what the real thing is the way to talk about it is as a metaphor that, you know, the traditional roles for men inside tribes, inside Indian tribes, are gone. The idea of being the hunter and the fisher, that's all gone. The traditional roles for women have stayed the same. You know, you're still a mother. You're still, you know, working in the house. And certainly these are very traditional gender roles. And depending on the tribe, men or women could fulfill any gender role they wanted. But female gender roles, feminine gender roles, the idea of what a holy spiritual female can be is still the same. The songs are the same. And Indian males have lost much of what is that and have failed to connect 21st century pursuits with the idea of being, you know, a member of a tribe. The idea that going to college is every bit as brave and amazing as going on the hunt.
We're speaking with author Sherman Alexie, whose latest book is a collection of short stories entitled Blasphemy. One of your stories is called The Only Traffic Signal on the Reservation Doesn't Flash Red Anymore. It's about reservation heroes, Indians with potential. Unfortunately, that's all they have sometimes. They end up stuck on the reservation. You really are a reservation hero, Sherman. With everything against you, poverty, abuse, your parents' alcoholism, the fact that you were born with a birth defect. How did you escape?
You know, after many years of thinking about it and talking about it, I realized it comes down to something really basic. Well, I was really sick. I was hydrocephalic at birth, had brain surgery at 5 months of age, and spent the first 7 years of my life in and out of hospitals and in extensive physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, all paid for by the U.S. government. So I essentially became who I was because I had this extensive preschool education funded by the U.S. government. I call it the brain damage Montessori, is what I had. So really, I was saved by federal liberalism.
Well, it's funny you mention that because conservatives have attacked, they have used reservations as examples of the failure of socialism. You would disagree with that, I assume?
Oh, and maybe the failures of socialism would be a part of it. Certainly, I'm suspicious of universal health care and government health care because that's what Indian tribes have had. That's what I grew up on, was government-sponsored health care. And I think the problems with the website management, the bureaucracy involved in the failure of the Obamacare website, you know, have echoes for me in every failure in the Indian Health Service. Not because it isn't a good idea, not because it isn't compassionate, not because it isn't the right thing to do, but simply because this massive bureaucracy can't get their stuff together. But I think the big part of the failure of reservations is actually capitalism. Most reservations have been subject to you know, the worst kind of rapacious, vulturous behavior by U.S. corporations with mining uranium, mining coal, mining forests, farmland, water interests. And when a corporation comes in, they're not paying anybody to do this. They come in, they steal everything, and they leave. And they have not, they've violated treaty rights constantly that we weren't protected. So they, you know, took all of our resources, violated our treaty rights. And of course, that's going to leave us poor and helpless and desperate. So I think it's a combination of government failure and corporate vulturism.
Well, then, and I don't want to make light of it, but are casinos the Indians' revenge against?
Oh, yeah, I really love that we're participating in the worst parts of capitalism to benefit ourselves. The thing to remember, and the Indians forget this, is that reservations were created as an act of war. We did not conceive of reservations. We never would have conceived as reservations. The U.S. government and the U.S. military together created the reservation system. And it was a place where Indians were supposed to go to disappear and or die. And I think that's still their function. And overall, the big thing to remember is that approximately 70% of Native Americans live off the reservation. You know, our urban-rural population, our demographics are almost exactly the same as the rest of the country. Native Americans are exactly as urban as every other group of people in the United States. And so once we start destroying the myth of the reservation being the sole measurement, the sole identity of Native Americans, then we can start going about changing reservations.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to ask you a question about style. Your stories are spare. There's very little description. And yet, you really do get a grasp of the characters. When you write, how important is description to you?
You know, not very, usually, and I don't really think about it. You know, I write reflexively, and I'd love to be, often I would love to be more verbose, more lush in my descriptions of the world, but it's just not who I am as a person.
But still, I think it works.
I mean, it's a style that's been used by all sorts of folks. You know, greater writers than I. You know, Hemingway is very spare. I guess you could say I come from the Emily Dickinson Hemingway school more than the Marianne Moore Faulkner school of literature.
Well, when you first got noticed, the New York Times Book Review called you one of the great lyric voices of his time.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you dined on that for about a year.
I'm still dining on that. It's the first quote on my website.
But this was on poetry, not fiction, correct?
Yeah.
So you write both poetry and fiction.
Yes.
Which one do you have a preference?
I still consider myself primarily a poet, and it's still primarily what I write. I'm lucky enough that fiction is my day job. I mean, I've been a full-time writer supporting myself for 20 years now, which is amazing in any era.
But what's the division of labor? Like, is there poetry in the morning and fiction in the afternoon?
It's poetry all day. I wrote one today, a poem. I doubt I'll get to any fiction today because I'll be traveling. So I would say I probably spend 70% of my time working on poems.
You also write novels.
Yes, very reluctantly.
Why reluctantly?
I mean, they're like marathons, and poems are sprints. You know, I'm a sprinter. It's like asking a 100-meter dash to run a marathon. It just feels like a whole different set of muscles.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Sherman Alexie. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez, and you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is novelist, poet, and short story writer Sherman Alexie, whose latest book is entitled Blasphemy. Why is it called Blasphemy?
I get accused of that all the time by Indians and non-Indians in a religious and cultural sense, by natives certain natives, because I write about things we're not supposed to write about, our social problems, our humanity, essentially. And when you're a brown-skinned writer, member of a minority, so-called minority, the pressure on artists is to be more public relations businesses than it is to be individual artists, that we're supposed to be representing our people in some positive light rather than telling our stories in the way we see fit as individual artists. So my whole career in a lot of ways is viewed by certain conservative Indians as being blasphemous. And
well, the photograph at the cover is of you, I think, wearing a mullet. Is that
not that photo. That one's not a mullet.
Oh, okay.
I've had other mullet photos. Yes,
but you write that there's a certain political aspect to the mullet.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's another photo. I wore a mullet for many years, and the mullet gets made fun of a lot, which is very interesting to me because it's a very classist argument. And it's primarily directed toward poor white people who have no defenders at all. You can insult poor white people in a way you cannot insult any other group. You certainly couldn't mock, 1970s giant afros with the same sort of disdain that people mock the mullet. But Indians also wore the mullet, and warriors wore the mullet. The Nez Perce tribe, for instance, who I'm close to and related to, they had the short in front, long in the back. And that, the joke about, the front meant business and the back was the party. And, my joke was always, I keep it short in the front so I can see it when I'm kicking your butt. But I really kept the hair for the style for longer than I needed to out of a basic insecurity, wanting to be seen as being very reservation Indian. It's a very res Indian hairstyle. And I was mocked by other Indians, urban Indians.
For not assimilating.
For keeping the hair, getting mocked for having a res hairstyle. Yeah. So there was all sorts of class stuff playing within the Indian community as well around it. The way it made people react to me, it makes me want to grow it back in a lot of ways. And one of the things I do now, because, as an Indian, as a public figure Indian, as an Indian artist, the way you look, the way you talk is always on display, is always measured, is always commented upon. Last night, because when I'm out in public, not today because I'm leaving, but I dress up. Generally speaking, I would have been here in a tie and a coat. Even though it was radio, I would have been in a tie and a coat. So last night I was in my pink tie and my blue coat and my, crazy striped shirt. And a white woman came up to me and said, you came in here wearing that tie. And I, why are you wearing that tie? It's white. And
she didn't like the fact you had a white tie.
My tie was, a measure of whiteness. Wearing a tie was a measure of whiteness. And I said, well, first of all, it's racist because you're assuming I'm supposed to look a certain way as an Indian or dress a certain way as an Indian. You're also assuming that I don't do this on purpose to set a trap for, secret liberal racists like you.
Well, we're speaking with author Sherman Alexie, whose latest book is Blasphemy. And there's a quote in one of your stories that caught my eye. It's the small things that hurt the most. The white waitress who wouldn't take an order, Tonto, the Washington Redskins. They've been in the news lately. What do you think about the controversy? Should they change their name?
Oh, absolutely. I don't mess around here. It's racist, and if you support the mascots, you're being racist. This is not about pride or culture, or it's out-and-out racism. Just to cite one example, the Washington Redskins, the man who created the mascot, the owner at the time, whose name is escaping me right now, he was a professional racist. The Washington Redskins were the last NFL team to racially integrate, and they very purposefully protested it. And the NFL forced them to draft black football players, and this was in 1963. So are you telling me that this man who so voraciously and ferociously fought racial integration somehow created this Indian mascot out of some liberal goodness, out of some way of honoring a different race? No, the mascot was conceived by a racist man in a racist era, and it remains racist.
Well, what do you think about some defenders of the team's name have pointed to a poll among Native Americans which says that most of them don't have a problem with the name.
The poll was horribly conducted, number one. It called people, it was conducted, 20 years ago now? And it was, they call people, and anybody who identified as having Native American blood was part of the poll. You know, everybody in the country identifies as having Native American blood. It's an interesting thing. But there's another poll that was conducted by News from Indian Country that actually talked to Indian people, and the poll results were much more different. 65% of Native Americans in that poll had an issue with the mascot. And above all else, let's make this real. Even those Indians who believe that the mascots are okay, who support them, I don't think it's a big deal. You know, I challenged them that if they were in a bar or in a restaurant somewhere and some group of white guys came in and started calling that Indian person Redskin, started doing war whoops, started waving tomahawks in the room, how honored do you think they'd feel? You know, you take the mascot out of the sporting context, you take those names, those images, those displays of so-called honoring, and you put them in a real-world context, and they quickly would be perceived as racist by anybody.
We're speaking with Sherman Alexie, whose latest book is Blasphemy. Another small thing that hurts is Tonto, the Lone Ranger movie starring Johnny Depp as Tonto. It bombed at the box office. But once again, Tonto, a movie Indian, was played by a white actor. This has happened a lot in TV, on TV and movies. What do you think about that?
I didn't see the movie. I had no interest, so I can't really comment on the movie. But,
well, just about just the idea
but,
of...
But the thing is...
white actors playing Indians.
That's never not changed. We've never had a chance to portray ourselves in a mainstream way. In a mainstream movie, Dances with Wolf was the last one, or maybe Windtalkers. Adam Beach had a couple of roles. Flags of Our Fathers, you know, he's a Cree Indian from Canada who played Indians, Navajos. And but the fact remains is that there are no contemporary roles in mainstream movies for Native Americans. There are no actors who are Native Americans who get cast in mainstream roles without a specific ethnic designation. And the last time I can remember that even happening was Wes Studi playing a cop in Michael Mann's Heat with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, where he was just playing a character and his Indianness wasn't even mentioned. So Indian actors don't even get that chance.
He was in The Last of Mohicans.
Yes, and so I assume that's where he made his friendship with Michael Mann and then was cast in subsequent Michael Mann movies.
Right.
So, you know, we don't even get a chance to play other people.
Yes, basically you have to play Indian or some...
But they don't even get cast as, you know, an Indian actor doesn't get to play Cuban or Italian, even though Italian and Cubans get to play Indians. So the reverse doesn't happen. We don't get to play, even though, you know, and I look similar and you and I could play each other in a movie. I would never be cast as you, as a Cuban, but you could be cast as me in Hollywood.
That's funny because... one of the most famous Indians in popular culture is the crying Indian from that TV commercial in the 1970s dealing with pollution.
Iron Eyes Cody, who was Greek.
No, I think he was Italian.
Was he Italian? Yeah.
He's an Italian-American. He's an Italian-American actor.
Yeah.
Was playing this. Well, but also, I mean, you made a funny comment about the Twilight werewolves. Because the Twilight, because these are Indians. Or at least they're supposed
to be. Well, the four... secondary werewolves are Indian actors. The lead werewolf is a German-American
guy. The one without his shirt off.
Taylor, well, they all have their shirts off. Taylor Lautner, the lead actor. He's German-American, I believe.
German-American. But what did you say about the Twilight werewolves, that the most unrealistic thing about them is that they have stomach muscles?
Yeah, real Indian werewolves would be dragging their furry bellies across the ground.
Why? Because they're just overweight?
Because we're Americans and we're overweight.
Yeah, they are pretty chiseled, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly.
That's funny. What are you planning on next? Do you have anything?
Oh, you know, I always have a bunch of books working on. I'm working on the sequel to my young adult novel. I'm working on...
This is the...
The Absolutely
the
absolute True Diary of,
Diary of a Part-Time Indian. For which you won the National Book Award.
Yes. Working on the sequel to that. Working on a book of short stories for teens. I have a picture book coming out next year.
Picture book and what
kids,
kind
for of... kids, for young kids.
Oh, for kids?
A picture book.
Like a pop-up?
It's not a pop-up, but it's a picture book. It's like a snowy day or you know... Okay. Or Here's a Who, you know, it's that kind of picture book. And it's a picture book I write, so it's rowdy. You know, it's for the rowdy 6-year-old set. So, yeah, I'm always got things going on.
Well, thank you for coming. We've been speaking with Sherman Alexie.
Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. He reviews books in the Miami Herald and also blogs on Huffington Post. So that wraps us up. Our producer is Richard Ives, technical direction by online producer Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website, WLRN.org. More information, links, and discussion at the famous Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. And tomorrow's program is with South Florida icon Carl Hiaasen. He grew up in Plantation, began at the Miami Herald at age 23, and has written teams of novels, nonfiction, and kids' books, all while composing a weekly newspaper column. And the calendar on this day in 1904, 110 years ago, the birth of Charles Pretty Boy Floyd in Adairsville, Georgia. Attached to the underworld in Kansas City, he committed a number of Midwest bank heists. He was played by Johnny Depp in Public Enemy. And on this day in 1920, 94 years ago, the birth of Dr. Henry Heimlich of choking maneuver fame. Oh, the American Red Cross no longer officially refers to him. One more while we remember the day the music died. On this day in 1959, 55 years ago, the death of the Big Bopper, Buddy Holly, and Ritchie Valens in a Beechcraft plane crash outside Mason City, Iowa. So we leave with these famous lines from the Big Bopper. There ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl. Make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose like a long-necked goose. Oh, baby, that's what I like. Is that too much, Paul? Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Stay with us for Here and Now next from NPR News.